So you guys look festive. What's happening? Overtime? So you just race? Oh, more so than take notes? A little bit. Well, I've had that feeling on occasion. A lot. Well, I think I was boring you with McNary Hagen last time, but I want to go back and... Yahoo. The McNary Hagen Bill of 1927 and 1928, which was in item 15. I rambled a lot about politics rather than the bill, and so I was really talking about was the ramifications and effects rather than the causes of what I was working on. But the McNary Hagen Bill in number 15 was an agriculture bill proposed in Congress to relieve the problems that farmers are experiencing, and maybe it helps to come back and explain farmers' problems, because that'll make more sense in the 1930s. We've been through this together, and that is that the farmers start to grow in large numbers. There are more farmers in relation to the number of people in America than there is food being produced. That's a lie. I just lied. The reverse is the case. They produce more farm products than there are actually farmers. From the 1870s on, technology makes it possible for farmers to overproduce continually in the Gilded Age. And so with the overproduction, even with growing markets of people, they don't grow as fast as the production, prices wane. And that's why we went through the farmer alliances, the Granger movement first, and the Populist Party, and none of that really get brought concrete success to the farmers. That which did bring some relief or some improvement for the farmers was World War I, the increased markets of Europe. And that market was lost right after the 20s comes because, as we've already talked about, the debt problems as well as the retaliation against the Fordy McCumber tariff. So that farmers in the late 20s are back to where they'd been before, and that is overproducing, causing prices to drop. So that's why the McNary-Hagen bill proposes to have the government buy up all the surplus farm products that can't be sold on the regular market, dump them overseas, for whatever they can get for it, and then pay the farmer. Well, they pay the farmer when they buy it up, and the farmer. This part always confused me. Would pay some kind of a processing fee to have the government buy their excess crops. Since the program never really came into existence, I guess you don't have to explain too well why it would work because it never did. But the concept behind it is that the government will guarantee that farmers will make so much money every year for their efforts. And I made that comparison. Why in no other industry was there such a guarantee by government that people who make automobiles will always get paid even if nobody buys the automobiles, etc. And the reasoning behind it that I was trying to get across was that there is a certain social historical significance attached to the farming community. It tends to be considered as the patriotic salt of the earth people that can't be abandoned. Food's vital, of course, and they're feeling that way, even though the problem is there's too much food. And then the other part, which can't be ignored, is that even if this is a community that a percentage compared to the city folk is getting smaller, it's still nearly 50% of the people in America, and that's a large voting block. That does not mean that farmers will vote in one block, because southern farmers are going to be thinking different than northern, midwest, and far west farmers due to ethnicity and geography and the Civil War, etc. But McNary-Hagen would have been some kind of a relief program, which really would have made a socialist add-on to free market farming. And that's why it failed in the 20s. That's why it was failed to get through both houses in 27, and when it got through both houses in 28, it was vetoed by Coolidge, because the essence of it is just not laissez-faire. It's government interference, government assistance, whatever you want to call it. And that's in keeping with the Republican Party's philosophy towards business, but it's also what both parties would have pursued in the 20s. So McNary-Hagen is ahead of its time. And then when we get to the Depression, that's something FDR will reverse. He will sign into law the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which will do close to the same thing, and that is use the government to buy up or at least create a chance for them to get paid for things that wouldn't sell on the open market. That's the sort of. And now we're in a different realm. This is 16. 16 is a look at the social history of the 20s. And I want to come back and first jump over to 17 and use 17 to explain 16. That is the census report that comes out every 10 years, the census report that we talked about in 1890 that Frederick Jackson Turner used to judge the vanishing frontier. By 1920, the census report, speaking of census reports, just got to get off topic here. The last one we just had, 2000 report, reported that there is 10.5% African Americans in the United States, but 13% Hispanic in the United States. That was 2000. It's now, what, 2007? So we're 3 years away from another census report. What's likely to be shown there? Yes, I mean, it wouldn't be out of expectations to see 15 to 18% Hispanic of the American population. There's a number of things that census reports have an impact on. Politically, it's obvious that what's going to be the case. Yes, that politicians will be looking for what policies should they back because of a growing or shrinking, or not back, because of a growing or shrinking population voting base. And therefore, the Hispanic voters, of course, the question arises there, and I'm not being mean here, but how many of those can be and are registered voters? But even if you reach the point where 18 or 19% is Hispanic, if you have three-fourths of that as registered voters, or even 50%, you're still looking at a sizable amount as that number grows. So and then in business also, businesses will look and see exactly what kind of people living where will buy what, and what should they be marketing. And that's where I wanted to take this back into 1920. But if you look at number 17, the census report of 1920 showed for the first time, by a very slim margin, more people living in urban areas, city areas, than living in rural areas in America. So that there's at first glance, there's some kind of a, I guess you might say, spiritual watershed there, that the belief that America is a nation of farmers is no longer true, or at least it's no longer majority true. Pardon? That if more people, by just a slim margin, like say 51, I don't know if it was 51 or 52, but 51% of the people in America reside in urban areas and cities, and maybe 49% live in rural or farm areas, it doesn't support the traditional notion that America is a nation of small farmers and rural people with rural values. And we know the stereotypes that goes with whether someone's a country person versus a city person, rural values versus urban values. And I guess we could say when we talked about immigration, even though there were these large numbers of Eastern European immigrants filling up the cities, there still was a belief in, how can I put this without sounding mean? A good old boy from Missouri could feel comfortable even in 1910 or 1915 that there's more of we WASP than there are them people coming in. That's a sensitive way to put it. But after 1920, even though city people are still going to be a majority Anglo-Saxon, there is this kind of awareness that there's more people in the cities, and city people are not like rural people, and they can be ethnically diverse. So what's happening to America? The culture is changing. And for those who are very conservative, that can be alarming and shocking to think that traditional small farmer, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant families may not forever be the dominant cultural force in America, is what I'm getting at. And that's reflected in advertising and marketing. People will purposely start to sell to those who live in the cities, and we'll see this especially how this affects the prohibition and liquor industry, which is supposed to be dead but won't be in the 20s. Historians also point out that there is this false portrayal of America as being 75% in the cities, not that many people in the farms. And they also will portray that life for all Americans is one of prosperity because they're looking at the city people. And that's not really accurate because, as we know, farmers suffered, and nearly 50% of the people are farmers. So that's what, I guess, when Hollywood and fiction literature is used to represent the past, you can get a skewed image, and the skewed image of the 20s is everybody's prosperous and most everybody lives in cities. Well, of the social transpositions that we've been speaking of, there is, for the first time, the growth of suburban population. So still connected to the cities on the outskirts, not separate small towns, but part of the outskirts of New York City or Chicago or Boston or something like that. And why would it be possible for suburban growth to exist, especially if these people living in those areas are still working in downtown major urban cities?
Expectations
automobiles. It was transportation, whether it's public transportation in the Northeast, but really more like automobiles everywhere. So when automobile traffic is transportation is more affordable and possible, then so does that mean housing patterns can change. And why automobile access was there is down at the bottom of my list, and that is because of Henry Ford. Henry Ford's assembly line made it possible to mass produce cars cheap enough that the average person now, at least on credit, could afford a car. And the first cars were the Model T, 10 Lizzies, as they're labeled there, and Ford used to brag that you could have them in any color you liked as long as they were black. That's the famous line. Ford made money by upping his wages of his workers more than anyone else to the shocking amount of $5 a day for employment at this time. $5 a day wages for Ford employees. And the reason he paid them so well was to make sure they didn't join unions and organize and demand other benefits. And so that's what Theodore Roosevelt had always said. If the employers would provide the benefits ahead of time, they would ward off such confrontations and organizations. Let's see, what else can we say about the 20s? It's a time of airline traffic, commercial airline traffic. The first planes, the first successful airline traffic was seaplanes. Why seaplanes more so than ground planes? You get that image from the movies, those big, huge seaplanes landing and all luxury passengers. There's no runways,
yeah.
So it's easy to land on water. I just read that in recent years, and so therefore the coastal areas are going to be involving a lot more opportunity for air transport. First commercial radio stations come into being in the 1920s. The very first one, in fact, is a Pittsburgh station, which is still in business today. KDKA was the first station.
KDKA,
yes. Time of silent movies in Hollywood, silent film stars. One of the films, it's a little bit before the 20s, but it's lumped in there as part of the new ways of entertainment, is listed in number 22, Birth of a Nation. And we'll talk about Birth of a Nation when we get down there and why it was such an impact. But the 20s entertainment culture really reflects the return to normalcy feelings of, we're tired of sacrifice, we're tired of crusades and missions, let's just party and have fun. And that's overly portrayed in the history of the 20s, or it really went on, but the feeling that for college students, what's life about? It's seeing how many people you can stuff in a phone booth, or how many goldfish you can eat, or how long can somebody sit on a flagpole. Those are 20s entertainment images. Babe Ruth is a hero of the 20s. Why is this? Yeah, because he sets records. In fact, in 1927, he set what record? 60 home runs. Of course, there's an asterisk that goes with that. We talk about home runs and asterisks. Roger Maris hit 61 home runs in 1961, and as a 9-year-old, I remember watching all the hoopla that went with that. But there was an asterisk that went with Maris, and what was that? Yeah, extra games. So he didn't do it 154 games. Is that what Ruth fit it in? So, and the asterisk, I think, has finally been removed recently. And then, of course, our recent folk have been hitting up in the 70s and 80 home runs, but their asterisk was steroids and corked bats. So what was Ruth's asterisk? Hot dogs and alcohol. That was the substances that he used for performance enhancing. I think he made, I can't remember, some huge, enormous figure in 1931, 32, and during the depths of the Depression, when asked why he felt he should earn more than the president. He said, because I had a better year. Also in 1927 is the feat accomplished by Charles Lindbergh.
What?
Charles Lindbergh. The feat, I haven't told what it was yet.
Okay.
His accomplishment was, what was it? First person to fly solo nonstop across the Atlantic, and winning a cash prize in so doing, after two different attempts before him, it had resulted in the death of the people who had tried. So, And that not only is you know, something to be proud of as a nation, but it also kind of reinforces that image that we have and the world has, that America is the leader of technology and research and exploration, and that Lindbergh embodied that. There's a really interesting film made in, I think, 1953 or 54, with Jimmy Stewart in it playing Lindbergh. It's a great film, and most of it's accurate, but you get a real good feeling for what Lindbergh was thinking and what America was thinking at the time. So that's worth renting and watching if you get the chance. Lindbergh had the 30s weren't so good to him, and I think 31 or 32, his child was kidnapped and held for ransom and eventually killed, and all the attention that was brought to that created the first federal kidnapping laws. And in the later 30s, Lindbergh was invited to go to Germany on more than one occasion and meet Hitler. And Hitler gave him awards and cross of irons with swastikas on it. And he wore them proudly and said he was proud to be both a German and an American. And German-American heritage is something you can celebrate. And in the late 30s, these German-American organizations would dress up in uniforms, kind of like Cub Scouts, with a little bit of a Nazi image to them. And they would attend meetings where on the walls would be these big posters of Washington and the American flag and Hitler and the swastika, and if the emphasis of the meetings was celebrate heritage, you can be proud to be a German and an American at the same time. And Lindbergh was pretty cozy with all those people, so when World War II came, his image was pretty blasted by all that. And he volunteered to fly, and I don't know if he ever got a chance to, but he never was trusted. So things were better for him in 1927. That same year, 1927, saw the first first movie with spoken dialogue in it, The Jazz Singer, starring Al Jolson, who dressed up in blackface. Very racist film, but acceptable at the time by white communities in that period. So this is what usually, when you think about the 20s, or the so-called Roaring 20s, that you get an image over these social images rather than politics, or rather than the conservative economic theories of the times. Prohibition fits right into that, because prohibition creates the atmosphere of crime, the atmosphere of underground bars, the speakeasies that existed. The Volstead Act of 1919 gave Congress the authority to enforce the Prohibition Amendment, but it was a hopeless quest. The Volstead Act gave Congress the authority to allocate money to enforce the Prohibition Amendment. This is the basis for the Untouchables, the Elliot Ness FBI stories. And as I've said before, while some people claim that outlawing liquor made people want to drink more, I don't believe that. I think, again, people in the rural areas did not engage in that kind of behavior, or their stills didn't slow down, you could say that. But I think that the more urban population grows, the more natural alcohol consumption takes place. So if drinking did rise in the 20s, it's not in rebellion to the amendment, it's the natural outgrowth of population growth. It would have risen further without the amendment, I'm thinking. In 1928 or 29, this isn't on your quiz, 28 or 29, maybe 30, somewhere at the end of the 20s, Hoover, so it has to be probably 29 or 30, Hoover commissions or urges Congress to commission a study on how bad is prohibition being violated. And the conclusion that members of his own party, the Republicans, came up with is it's hopeless. It's that not only are people in every area, every walk of life, every income level, violating the laws, but they're starting to violate other laws with an attitude that law really doesn't matter anymore, and that if we want to get respect back for law, we need to repeal prohibition, which the Republican Party could not do. Democrats, throughout the 20s, had opposed prohibition and had promised if they won presidential elections and control of Congress, they would repeal prohibition. But Republicans would not. Why would the Republican Party be so much more reluctant? That's it. They're the conservative party socially. They're the ones that represent the people who wanted prohibition. And remember, I think we talked about this, that prohibition wasn't just an ethics issue. It was a cultural issue, that WASPy people thought that drinking is the abuse of drink is done by the immigrants. Well, the immigrants are the Democratic Party, and these WASPy people are the Republican Party. So that's why prohibition cut across the parties the way it did. And not surprising, after FDR wins the presidency in 1932 and Democrats win control of both houses of Congress, the 21st Amendment repeals prohibition. This next section is an area that I find more intriguing. I don't want to say that I enjoy it, because it's not anything positive to talk about, but if I find it more of interest to study, and that is how, instead of being such a great time of frivolity and joy and escape from responsibilities to make money and have fun, the 20s, socially, I think, is quite a conservative reactionary time period. It's a leap back into the past. And this is seen in, first, in immigration restrictions in number 19. As you recall, immigration was slowed to a near halt during World War I because of submarine activity. Right after the war was over in 1919 and 1920, it came back with a fury. Large numbers of Eastern European immigrants, probably many of them escaping the ravaged areas of Europe, of war. But what we're seeing is the same sources, Southern and Eastern European immigrants, Jewish, Roman Catholic, Slavic. These are the people that are again coming into America in 1919 and 1920. And so the return to normalcy atmosphere of the election spills over into a demand for immigration restrictions. And some of that could well be related to the Bolshevik Revolution and the Palmer Raids, the belief that where these people are coming from is the hotbed of radicalism and communism, and so we shouldn't allow these kind of Al-Qaeda people to sneak in into our country type thing. So in 1921, the first immigration restriction law in American history was passed, if you disregard the Chinese Exclusion Act, the first for all people. And here's how it was called: the Emergency Immigration Act. Here's how it was set up. It said that instead of unlimited numbers, there would be a total amount of 350,000 people that could enter the United States in 1921. 350,000 total.
From what?
Well, starting after 1921.
What was this called?
The Emergency Immigration Act.
In 1921,
yes.
350,000 total immigrants allowed?
Into the country. That they could document, of course, that obviously they couldn't keep up with people coming across land borders, which is small numbers at this time. And then the law would also say, of that 350,000, if you went back to the year 1910 and looked at how many people in America were immigrants from given countries, how many Austrians, how many Germans, how many Irish, etc., 3% of the 350,000 of that basis could come in. So therefore, what you're looking at is what was the ethnic population of 1910 in a miniature. That's what we hope we can repeat. So that in 1910, which is still a lot of Southern Eastern Europeans, but less, more so more Nordic, Northwestern people were coming in. It'll probably make more sense when we get the second law into place here. In 1924, the Johnson-Reed Act, or as some textbooks call it, the National Origins Act, Johnson-Reed Act or National Origins Act.
What was the second?
It's either called the National Origins Act or the Johnson-Reed Act. It drops the total to 150,000, and that's alarming because or shocking in comparison to the fact that well over a million a year was coming, and now it's down to 10% of that figure. 150,000 total. The base year, this is real significant, is shoved back to 1890. And 1% of the populations of those groups can make up the 150,000. So what do we know to be true about the 1890 year in regards to the source of immigrants? That's when the shift started. So in 1889 and 1890, you still have a majority of Nordic people, Northern and Western, Teutonic, Aryan, Anglo-Saxon, Celtic people coming in. The Slavic, the Italian, the Chinese, even that too, and the Jewish people, they're next to hardly measurable trace amounts in 1890. And also in this law, there is a complete ban on East Asian immigrants, and that's targeting Japanese, since the Chinese were already outlawed in 1882. Now, this puts a total ban on Japanese immigrants because of their success in California at turning wetlands into successful farms. So a ban on Asian, especially Japanese immigrants after 1924. The exceptions would be, of course, direct family members who could show cause and need for it. But outside of that, there was a ban. And the people coming in 1924 will clearly reflect those at the time of or before 1890. So collectively together, what can we say about immigration restriction?
It was racist.
That's what I was looking for. I just wanted the numbers to speak for themselves. And those were the limits that remained until what year? 65. 19th part of the Johnson's social program things were to eliminate racist quotas on immigration. Not necessarily limit totals, or eliminate totals, but eliminate the split by race. There were exceptions between 1924 and 1965 after World War II, and during the Cold War there were special exceptions given to victims of Nazism or communist activity in Eastern Europe. But for the most part it was held until 1965. Another reflection of the conservative era of this time is the growth of the Red Scare, which we've alluded to earlier already with the Palmer Raids. It's not surprising that the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia was feared by most Western capitalist nations as the launching point or the starting point of worldwide revolution. So there's the Palmer Raids of 1919. Most union leaders are suspect in the 20s. People who were members of the Socialist Party or the IWW are harassed and their writings are suppressed and people are jailed. There's a court case in 1925, which is definitely not on our test, but it's useful in a government class, called Gitlow versus New York. And it's a case that said that it starts with the Schenck case. Remember the Schenck case when they were urging people not to go to recruiters because it violated the 13th Amendment? That was branded by the Supreme Court as a clear and present danger, and that was the crowded fire theater theory, that it's an endangerment to even advocate such ideas. Well, the 1920s, there's no war on. There's nobody trying to discourage war recruitment. But if you just wrote socialist literature saying that we should have a socialist government, change from a capitalist form to socialist, that kind of literature alone getting published in many states outlawed as being a bad tendency of speech. And the Gitlow case of 1925 upheld a conviction of a New Yorker just for writing socialist nonfiction literature. So that shows the lack of free speech opportunities in the 20s because of the fear of left-wing radicalism. Gitlow versus New York. Gitlow. Not on our test, but reflects the 20s well. And again, since most union leaders still at this time period tend to be of Eastern European origin, there was that connection with immigration restriction and with the Palmer Raids and associating with Red activity. So there is a Red Scare in the 20s, and there is one in the 50s. And they kind of follow similar patterns, a post-war period of conservative retrenchment and the fear of Eastern Europeans.
At this time, was the communist
manifesto in favor? Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you tried to sell it in bookstores, now if it was already in libraries, they didn't take them out of libraries, but to try to market them and sell them was to get you in trouble. Now, people who checked them out of libraries, names went on FBI records. That stayed until the 1960s, and it came back after the Patriot Act, checking on what you're reading. There are a couple of people here that end up being martyrs to this period. In item 21, Nicholas Sacco and Bartholomew Vanzetti. Sacco and Vanzetti, two Italian fish merchants who were anarchists at heart, and I think one of them was an atheist. So, and you can tell by their names that they're also Italian. So, Sacco and Vanzetti and number 21.
What was Vanzetti's first name?
Bartholomew, I think. Italians, anarchists, quasi-socialists, active in the political movements, they're pretty guilty of anything you want to accuse them of already. And they are accused in 1920 of having robbed a mail car and killed the driver. When they went to trial, the judge created an atmosphere of that was not at all just or fair by complaining that these slobs needed to be put in prison just for being anarchists. And they did receive help from a legal organization, the ACLU. Have we talked about them? Which was founded the year this occurred, 1920, the American Civil Liberties Union. It's a legal fund, legal group that doesn't charge for cases, but they take on what they think are going to be landmark cases to protect the Bill of Rights. And this was one of the very first cases they took on as a Saccone Vanzetti case, and fought it for 7 years, finally losing in 1927 when both were executed. In, I think it was 1984, Governor Dukakis of Massachusetts, after looking at all the evidence that followed their death, concluded that they had been framed, and they were, even though one of their guns were involved, there was no linkage of them actually being involved in the crime, and issued a formal pardon. A little late for them, but the case, though, they become, you know, cause celebres, they become the martyrs of the 20s, representing the severity of the Red Scare 20s. Here's this movie in number 22 that I was going to mention. Birth of a Nation was produced by, I'm trying to think of it all, so I forgot to forget his name. Douglas Fairbanks Sr., I think? Yes, no, he stars in it. D.W. Griffith, that's who it was. D.W. Griffith was the movie director that put together Birth of a Nation. And I think Fairbanks stars in it. This was the movie of the year, the movie of the decade. Big, big blockbuster success. The problem with the movie was it was false history and it was racist. And it's rentable, by the way, in its silent version of its Blockbuster if you want to rent it. And the movie portrays the Ku Klux Klan as being the heroes that rescue the South from free blacks, especially free blacks who attack white women. And those scenes are repeated in the film. It says that D.W. Griffith gave his servants free tickets to go see the film, and they were so infuriated, black servants, and they were so infuriated when they saw it that they quit and cursed him. And he was perplexed and lost. I gave him free tickets. What are they upset about? The movie was viewed by Colonel William Joseph Simmons, and I'm suspicious of whether that colonel was a real rank, of Georgia, who, when he watched it in 1915, felt that's what was missing in the 20th century was the Klan, and there needed to be a new Klan. And so in 1915, Colonel William Joseph Simmons of Georgia watches the movie and decides there needs to be a new Klan. And this new Klan will not just deal with keeping African Americans in the place they're supposed to stay, but it'll also address the even larger threat of immigration and liberalism. So a Klan that is not just anti-black, but is, for the most part, very pro-WASPy conservative, gets its start in the early 20th century here by Simmons watching this movie. Caught on very popular in the 20s in southern and western areas, large memberships. So large that no politician could run against the Klan or speak against the Klan and get reelected in southern and western states. Oh, yeah. Police chiefs, governors, and had a Supreme Court judge that was a Klan member, Hugo Black, who later, after renouncing his Klan membership and became a Supreme Court judge, fought very long and hard in the late 40s and early 50s for civil rights before anybody else did. And was on the Klan hit list in Alabama, and he never could go back for that. So, see, a Klan membership was in many ways the vehicle for economic advancement in a lot of these areas. It had such a control over the Democratic Party, since the South was Democratic-based, that every time Northern politicians tried to introduce measures to outlaw lynching, the Klan could beat it and knock it down. The Klan took a great loss of membership, however, in 1927, when a guy named George Stevenson, I think his name was, raped his secretary. She tried to commit suicide. He prevented her from getting medical care, and she eventually died in his business office. And when all that came out in Kokomo, Indiana, he was the grand dragon of the Indiana Klan branch. Stevenson, I think. George Stevenson. Of the Indiana Klan branch. Yeah. It may have been just Stevens. I'm thinking Stevens or Stevenson. But that bad publicity hurt not just the Indiana Klan membership, but the national Klan membership. And so it shrank in the 30s and remained small until the 50s when the new civil rights venture. No, it was a white secretary.
Okay.
Yeah. It was just the cruelty of denying her medical care when she needed it that brought some bad publicity to the organization.
It brought the Klan
membership down.
Did he get just
he was convicted. I think he was executed too, if I remember correctly.
Did he keep her in his hospital or somebody's house?
I thought it was in his office, but pretty gruesome story. Another feature showing the conservative nature of the 1920s, another event here, which has a great movie about it also, is the Scopes Monkey Trial in item 23. And this is a film you should watch at least 60 times. I have, showing it in my high school classes year after year. Great film called Inherit the Wind. There's three versions of it, one made in 60, one made in 85, and one like 94. But the 1960 version with Spencer Tracy is the best for sure. It's not necessarily accurate of the trial, but it sends the left-wing agenda out that you need to see. So,
he died in the courtroom.
And it was 5 days after the trial in real life. But that was more dramatic. No, they don't. It was a play by two writers. Robert E. Lee is one of the writers of the play. They changed the name so they can play with the facts a little bit. So to do the name conversions, in fact, William Jennings Bryan, who will come and help the state of Tennessee in this situation, is called Matthew Harrison Brady in the film. Clarence Darrow, who we've talked about earlier with the Pullman strike, will come to defend Scopes. And Clarence Darrow in the film is called Henry Drummond. And Scopes himself is named Bertram Cates in the movie. And the guy who plays Scopes, or Bertram Cates, is Darren of Bewitched TV fame. Henry Morgan, who is still alive at 90 this year, Colonel Potter of MASH, plays the judge in the film. It's a great, great film. Well, the story, here's what happens. John Scopes is a biology teacher in Dayton, Tennessee. While I'm thinking of this, I think 3 years ago, Dayton, Tennessee outlawed gayety within the city limits. Being gay. So yeah, the city of Dayton, Tennessee said it's illegal to be gay in their city limits 3 years ago. I don't know. I didn't read the law. I don't know how one is guilty.
Did you have to go to the courthouse and get a stamp on your name?
I don't know. I think the purpose was to just dissuade people from coming or staying in the city. But anyway, I say that to give you a flavor of the city here. Dayton, Tennessee is where all this takes place. Tennessee, like other southern states in the 20s, passed laws making it illegal to teach any version of man's creation other than the Genesis version of the Bible. And Scopes, who is this biology teacher as well as football coach, maybe he's a basketball coach, he's one of the coaches in sports, was a believer in Darwinian evolution. And felt that was a new idea being discussed and researched in scientific communities, and that the kids of his school should have the opportunity to be exposed to a number of competing ideas, especially if it was science. So he contemplated teaching the Darwinian theory, knowing it would get him arrested and into trouble. And he talked with others in the town about his plan, and some of the other people in the town, business persons, got a hold of the ACLU, the organization that defended Sokol and Vanzetti. And they wrote to him and said that if he would be willing to teach it, get arrested, and go to trial, that they would send the best legal minds they could to defend him. And in reality, they sent three lawyers to defend him. But in the movie, it's only the Henry Drummond figure that shows up to help him. So he does it. Actually, he really doesn't do it. If you read a footnote in some of the books, it says the day he was supposed to teach the evolution class, he was sponsoring a sports trip. We never really got the thing taught, but he lied and claimed he did so he could get arrested. So he is arrested, put on trial, and it becomes a national focused trial when first William Jennings Bryan, who's long out of politics now, shows up to defend the state of Tennessee, defend the law against atheist Darwinism. And Clarence Darrow arrives representing the ACLU to defend Scopes' substantive due process rights of academic freedom. And I think what's interesting about this case is look at what's in competition here. On the one hand, you could say that... Pardon? Oh, it's definitely science and religion. You know, and it's also old-fashioned... Yeah, conservative ideas, the idea that we didn't descend from monkeys and that these atheist scientists are not going to tell us that global warming is real. I mean, I'll slip that one in. But Darrow represented the ACLU and came to represent Scopes in the trial, his right to teach it. But yeah, science versus religion, north versus south, city versus rural, modern versus traditional. Academic freedom, the right to expose people to all the different scientific ideas that are being taught in schools, versus, and this is the part I find real interesting, the right of local home rule of curriculum. If your kids are compelled by law to go to school, shouldn't you as a community of parents have the right to have some say-so over what is forcefully taught to your children? And if those things being taught to your children violate your most sacred religious beliefs, shouldn't you have the right to protect you from that kind of curriculum?
Was there something like that recently?
There was a move here just this year, at the start of this year, to try to introduce biblical literacy into the high school courses. And the promoters made the comment that it would not be to teach religion, it would be to teach it as literature. And then when the school wouldn't do it, they said, "You're all going to hell, you bunch of atheists." Because they didn't tell us that, but that did happen at the school board meeting.
Would have to stamp that in their textbooks now?
This is just a theory.
This is all theory.
Yeah. Which I'm not that opposed to. I could see, like, you know, Reaganomics, this is just a theory. I think there could be a lot of places where you could put that stamp.
Yeah.
William Jennings Bryan, our three-time presidential candidate, he's out of politics, but he's never been out of religious fervor. And so he believes that modernism and science is endangering the values of traditional America, and so he's going to defend the state of Tennessee's law against Scopes. When the trial takes place, Darrow goes after not whether Scopes taught it or not, because that's not something they're disputing. What they're going to argue is whether the law is legal. Does such a law on the books so defy the First Amendment that it's an unconstitutional law? And the prosecution and the judge come together pretty quickly is that we're not putting the law on trial, we're putting on whether the person broke the law on trial. So when Darrow tries to put into testimony the testimonies of zoologists and anthropologists and chemists from northern universities who want to speak on the possibility that you could reconcile Darwinism with Genesis, that they don't have to be necessarily in conflict, none of those people are allowed to speak because that's not relevant to whether or not the lesson was taught. So when he's unable to use any witnesses in that fashion, then Darrow gets this idea. Since he's really trying to challenge a fundamentalist view of the Bible, he says to Bryan, "Why don't you be my witness? You can cross-examine you on your knowledge of the Bible." And he was extremely proud of his biblical knowledge, so he agreed. And so there's a couple of days of cross-examination where he's just trying to attack him on what seems to be contradictions in the Bible, asking about things like... if Cain knew his wife, was there another creation that took place nearby that was never recorded in the Bible? When was the sun made? Was it made on the second or third day? If so, how long was the first day? If there was no sun to measure it, was it a 24-hour day? Was it a 25-hour day? Was it a 28-hour day? Was it a 28-million-year day? And therefore, the whole point that he was trying to get at was that even biblical scholars interpret rather than read strictly by the book, and therefore... through interpretive loose construction, if we use the political term for it, one could still reconcile Genesis and Darwin. But bad publicity to the state that was going across the nation caused the governor of Tennessee to become so alarmed that he called the judge and said, "Finish this thing as quickly as possible." And so the judge closed it off in a hurry and gave Scopes a fine of $100. And they appealed it and he never paid it. And Scopes had it overturned. Never went back into public teaching in Tennessee. Went to the University of Chicago to do a PhD in mineralogy. And right before he was to get his degree, the president of the university discovered that Scopes was about to get a PhD from there. Kicked him out of the college. He never got his degree. So he went off to work for Sun Oil in Brazil and became a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So they fined him. He never paid it.
Right.
And then he went to Chicago.
And went to school, never got his degree, and eventually went to work for Sun Oil down in Brazil. You may recall that those of you alive in this time period may recall that in 1981, I think it was, there was a creation science bill signed into law by Frank White, Governor Frank White. The reason I remember this so vividly is because the day he signed it into law was the day my kid was born. And my wife, who was going through horrible agony and labor when I was in it, I was reading to her, wow, look at this new creation science bill. This is going to be a great legal fight. And her focus was not on creation science at the time. But he'd signed it into law without ever reading it. And it was challenged for its constitutionality and was overturned, the Arkansas provision. The creation science law said that if you teach Darwinism, you must also teach creation science theory. So what a reverse it was at one point, outlawing Darwinism before, now to the point where if Darwinism is taught, you must also make available the other view. And there's a new movement for what's called intelligent design, which is not too far away from creation science. It's interesting the way scientists are so guarded against allowing any kind of creation theory into classes. I would think, of course I'm not a scientist, I teach history, but isn't the scientific method supposed to be the standard you work from? So no matter how many different creation theories somebody wants to introduce, bring them on in, test them, repeat the test, form hypotheses, go through the whole scientific method and see which ones are true. Wouldn't that be a lot more courageous than just saying they can't risk their own theories being disproven? Possibly. Well, that's true. That's true, yeah. So it's quite a controversy. Yeah. Well, it's amazing how many biology teachers in the public schools find it so convenient to run out of time that semester and never teach any part. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is definitely their right to do so. And
at the same time, I mean, they're doing a criminal injustice, though, because
by the deny.
Because basically, they just taught something that they didn't
know. Ooh.
But in a sense, you know, I think that anything that you do learn allows you to have more of an open mind about things.
That's true. Well, but what you say is that's an interesting thing when people say if you don't like this part of the lesson, you can opt out. I don't want people opting out of the New Deal. I want them to worship FDR. I don't want it to be a choice. I think there's certain truths that need to be taught as truths. That was sarcastic there. But that's the one they used to say for the prayer in school thing, that for those who are uncomfortable with prayer, you can step outside while the rest pray. Well, I think there's something kind of... I'm real uncomfortable with that there's an education activity that is not good enough to force everybody to do it. I think everybody should be forced to do... Little Mohammed, the... definitely not going to feel like stepping outside. Yeah, but I've always been a believer that if you're going to use time and school money to introduce something, you should force everybody to be a part of it. Or if you're going to get in trouble by forcing people, you shouldn't do it. And that works in this direction too. But again, the Scopes trial reflects that perfect cross of modern and traditional, and north and south, and city and urban, and religion and science. Home rule over curriculum versus national agendas. Great case for the 20s. Oh, Mencken?
Yeah.
H.L. Mencken was a reporter for the Baltimore Sun, who in the movie is played by Gene Kelly in the role of E.K. Hornbeck. He was a very caustic, cynical, sarcastic reporter who made fun of Dayton, Tennessee and everybody in that whole state for what he thought was being the bourgeoisie backwards folk. Pretty famous writer and pretty cynical person, too. So when you...
What was his role in the Scopes trial?
He's one of the many reporters that sent back to a national wire service what was going on in Tennessee, but did so with a lot of caustic sarcasm against the backwardness of the South, as he saw.
Which is what made the governor tell the judge...
Yeah, right. So, 19 through 25, if and we don't do this to you, but if you had to write an essay, what would 19 through at least 23, I mean 19 through 23, what would be your thesis that embodied all those events? Prejudice? Conservative, yeah. Not every part of that is necessarily prejudicial, but it's all conservative. It's more traditional. Fear of change. Fear of looking back to the time of the Gilded Age, is when America was a simpler time, purer country, free from the negative influences that had come into it. So that's what I...
The good old days.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. Return to normalcy socially. So that's how I... I think so. I think that modern science in the end of the 19th century. Yeah, and there were also movements to say, to try to disprove God on the basis that physics and chemistry can prove everything. And so there's a reaction against that. And I think also, when you see the devastation of World War I and World War II, there are those who say this is where your God of science has led us anyway to happen. So, a lot of ways to look at the 20s. It's a time of economic laissez-faire. It's a time of social conservative retrenchment. It's a time of seeming frivolity and fun and lack of commitment. Definitely a racist time period for sure. An upsurge in lynchings that occur from the 1920s through up into the 1950s. But at the same time, there is a growth of the black community or the African-American community in northern cities. We mentioned this migration. It starts with World War I employment and grows steadily through the 20s and manifests itself in an identification cultural movement known as the Harlem Renaissance in 24. And these names listed in 24 are some of the better-known writers and musical performers. James Weldon Johnson, who wrote The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. Zora Neale Hurston. Oh, you don't need to know the titles, just the authors. If I can even remember the title. Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God, who was not that well known at her time, but really was kind of brought into being in the 1970s, 60s and 70s.
What did James write?
James Weldon Johnson. The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man.
X as in
EX, yes. A theme that suggested that true black identity had been stripped by white society from days of slavery.
And Hurston wrote what?
Their Eyes Were Watching God, which I think was kind of the role model book that people like Maya Angelou and others followed in their writing. Toni Morrison also followed her. County Cullen, and I can't remember what title goes with County Cullen. Langston Hughes is the most famous of the time period. Works such as the Shakespeare in Harlem and the Way of White Folks.
Shakespeare in Harlem?
Mm-hmm. Now these two names below here, Cab Calloway and Louis Armstrong, are involved in rhythm and blues and other jazz music performances. Armstrong, of course, as a trumpeter and a singer, gets his start in the 20s. In the late 20s and into the early 30s is when Cab Calloway gets started. And you all know Cab Calloway. I know you do. The singer of Minnie the Moocher. Where did most people finally come to realize who Cab Calloway was? The Blues Brothers. He's the one at the bottom of the stairs when the nun slaps him with the ruler and knocks him down the stairs. He's the one that really raised them in the orphanage. And when they make their performance at the end of the movie at the Palace Hotel, and they're late getting there, and he does the dance in which they kind of flash back into the fancy costumes and instruments, that's the 20s. He's doing the Harlem Renaissance performances as he did when he was a young person, still in 1980. Cotton Club and Apollo Theater type performances is what that alludes to, which in the movie is alluded to and talked about. He was a dancer and a singer. And like inherit... Whom? Oh, yeah. Satchmo, as he was called. I can remember in the 60s the singing of Hello Dolly being a big hit. 1960s. So the three movies we're all going to go watch, right? The Spirit of St. Louis with Jimmy Stewart playing Lindbergh. Inherit the Wind with Spencer Tracy doing the Scopes trial. And then the Blues Brothers, which of course is more important than those first two. The foundation of American culture. Another person who is a prominent African-American cultural nationalist is Marcus Garvey, a Jamaican-born person, migrated to the United States and organized the Universal Negro Improvement Association. Its purpose was to convince African-Americans that their mission should be to return to the nation of their cultural roots, Africa. It's a massive migration to Africa movement, the Universal Negro Improvement Association. It's trying to convince black Americans that they'll never really achieve justice and fair property protection in the United States. They've got to return to the country of their origin, Africa. And what nation was he targeting? Liberia, which was set up exactly a century earlier in the 1820s, is a place where they freed slaves and drew people back. Well, that was already in bad turmoil already by the 1920s. So he never successfully migrated anybody, because in his collecting of monies, he was eventually arrested for mail fraud and deported. One of the big contributors to the Garvey movement, the Klan. Not surprising why. They gave large sums of money and helped drum up support. Garvey is one of the first people to emphasize culturally that the African-American community has its standards of beauty and standards of achievement upside down. That the black community is always trying to ape white culture. That light-skinned blacks were considered more attractive. That straight hair was more attractive. That losing the accent was considered more cultural or educated. And what Garvey argued was it's ludicrous to measure the black race by white standards. That instead, the more black standards you can establish, the prouder and the more successful and the more independent the black community will be. The blacks is beautiful slogan, natural Afro hairstyles. These all were first advocated by Garvey. And, of course, he doesn't last long enough to have an enduring decades-long influence on America, but Malcolm X's father was one of the organizers of Garvey's movement, and he taught that to his. And a lot of the organizers taught those ideas to the people who in the 1950s and 60s did bring this notion back alive again. Originally. I mean, the acceptance of it as an appropriate cultural beauty standard starts with Garvey. Most people in white society really feared Garvey because of this empowerment notion and the message that he was teaching, which is probably why he was convicted. I don't think the evidence is really there for mail fraud. They just wanted to get him out of the country in a hurry. Universal Negro Improvement Association. It was both a cultural movement as well as a back to Africa logistics movement. In fact, he put together a ship line called the Black Star Line, a play on the White Star Line of the Titanic. Well, we've still got a few minutes left. Let's go into number 26 here, the 1928 election. Unique, interesting election. Who was elected in 20 president? Wilson ran in 12 and 16.
Harding,
yes, returned to normalcy Harding. He died in his term. Who replaced him? And Coolidge ran for re-election in 24 and defeated John W. Davis and Robert La Follette. So who's going to be, why doesn't Coolidge run for re-election in 28? Probably because that would be 2.5 terms, I guess. So instead, who is the Republican candidate in 28? He'll be the Democratic candidate. Hoover, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Herbert Hoover is the Republican candidate. Herbert Hoover had run for no office prior to 1928, so why is he the candidate? Yes.
He was good with food.
And business, yeah. Yeah, he was an excellent coordinator of business and government, not through confrontation, not through regulation, not through harassment, but through partnership. And so if he made the prosperity, or the seeming prosperity for those in the city, of the 20s occur, then why not make him president so that the two chickens in every pot and a car in every garage slogan could continue to be real? They had it.
So Al Smith was the Democratic candidate.
Yes, that's what I was kind of saving my punchline here. For now the Democrats. Al Smith was the most prominent Northern Democratic politician of the 20s. Governor of New York since the teens. They had wanted him to be the candidate in 20 and in 24 both. But because of his Catholic Irish background, as well as his association with the Tammany Hall political machine, that's how he rose to prominence in New York, he just wasn't acceptable to the Klan.
So he was the most influential
Democratic Northern politician. But here's a person who's of Irish Catholic Tammany Hall background, wants to repeal Prohibition. So for your white Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Southern, and Western Klan members, that's just not going to get it in 1920-24. But after the decline of the Klan in 27, that makes it possible for Smith to become the candidate in 28. Now, what have we said about Southern state voting? Since they were solidly Democratic from the Civil War up until the 1960s. Why? Why would they always vote Democratic? There was no... It's a poverty issue, but it isn't a poverty issue related to urban poverty in the North. That's it. Republicans are the hated Yankee Northerners. Hell no, I ain't forgetting bumper sticker type thing. You've seen those. This election, they put the Civil War aside and hated Catholics more. Southern states crossed over and voted for Hoover this year. Not all of them, though. A few stayed loyal. Arkansas was one of them. Arkansas voted for Al Smith. Is that due to some large Catholic population in Arkansas? No, not hardly at all. I was thinking, maybe was it Irish, maybe was it German, maybe a small Klan population? No, it's because the running mate that year was Arkansas Senator Joe Robinson. So Al and Joe, not Al Gore or Joe Lieberman, but Al Smith and Joe Robinson, for the candidates in 1928, and so the Arkansans voted for a fellow Arkansan. And of course they lost. And some of the explanation after that was, how foolish, Arkansas had 6 electoral votes, you can't win presidential elections with Arkansan candidates, don't ever do that again. Is the lesson that came out of 1928. Well, even though Smith lost, one of the things that the Smith candidacy did do that didn't matter at the time when you lose, but looking later in the 30s with FDR's victories, is a lot of Irish voters had switched to McKinley in 96 and had kind of declared, we don't have to always be beholden to the Democratic Party. We can be Irish Americans, but also be middle-class conservative Republicans. And so what Smith does is bring the Irish vote, or the second and third generation of Irish American voters, back to the Democratic Party. And they will be there in place in 32 to help elect FDR. And there'll be bad blood there. FDR will win when Smith doesn't. Smith trained FDR in New York politics. He was his protege, but Smith never wins and FDR does. But Smith's the one who brought the Irish voters back to him. Let's not get depressed tonight. Let's do the stock market crash when we return.